KUOW's The Record on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke now, continuing my conversation with National Book Award winner, poet, novelist Sherman Alexie, whose new memoir is called You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. Sherman, you ready to make a U-turn from the NBA?
A screaming U-turn.
Yeah.
From the minor league joys and terrors and fears and doubts of getting the Sonics back to my incredibly difficult relationship with my mother.
Well, thank you for writing about this. Your memoir on one level is about Lillian Alexie. So will you start by just telling us a little about Lillian?
Well, Lillian Alexie was my mother. She died in July 2015. She was a Spokane Indian, one of the last speakers of the old Spokane Indian language. It's been revitalized and is being taught again. But she was one of the last old-time speakers with a direct connection to the language and the cultures from time immemorial. One of the spiritual leaders of the tribe, but she was also, I think, undiagnosed bipolar. She was a chronic liar and manipulator. She was mean and sometimes violent. But she's also the woman who sobered up when I was 7 years old, which saved us.
Yep.
She's also the woman who was the drug and alcohol treatment counselor for our tribe for many years, who saved the lives of dozens of my fellow tribal members. So she was an incredibly complex, arrogant, opinionated woman who sucked all the energy out of every room she walked into. I have no idea why we didn't get along.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that. We'll talk about that. The word you use a lot about your mom is cruel. And when you picture her being cruel, what are you picturing?
Obvious lies. I'm thinking of one particular instance that's not actually in the book. She was over here with my sisters visiting us here in Seattle from the reservation, and I drew her a map. This was in the days before the internet. And I drew the greatest map in the history of the world with exact mileage and with landmarks and signs and bus stops. I mean, this was a work of art. I can draw if I take my time. And I took 2 days to draw this map, knowing they would have to make one right turn onto Martin Luther King and then a left on Pine to get to us. And so they went to a powwow and they came back that night. And my mother, on purpose, kept not making that turn.
Even though
the map was in front of them. And my sisters fought her 3 or 4 times as they went in a circle. But then they stopped. They just let her be who she was going to be. And she kept not making that turn. My sister's getting more and more angry, but inverted. And me at home knowing what she was doing. And I kept thinking, she's not turning on MLK. She's not turning on MLK. She's not turning on MLK. So that's what I mean by the cruelty she was capable of on even that basic level of not making a right turn from the map I gave her.
That was not the example I expected from you, because
Well, it could be her throwing the pop can in my head when I was a kid and knocking me out. It could be the time I was weeping because my father was gone on another alcoholic drinking binge, and I was weeping, and she threw me outside onto the porch and locked me out. And she tried to let me back in later, but I decided to sleep in the doghouse with our mutts instead. So it all blends together. It's the way in which cruelty can be everyday, ordinary to spectacular, but that it's a constant possibility. So that her unpredictable nature, her amazing beauty and magic, combined with her ability to be so mean.
Yeah, and that was always there.
Right.
Yeah. And yet, as you say, you write so beautifully about what I would call acts of love. That scene of her making quilts, with those fingers to keep food on the table and being in the front row of your readings, even though she felt ashamed by some of what you wrote, and letting you leave the reservation when you needed to. Why wasn't it those acts that stood out to you the most?
Well, those are in the book.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think I didn't give precedence to anything.
Yeah.
I didn't value anything over. I tried to present the full complex portrait of her. And I don't spare myself either.
No, you don't.
Because at some point, she was a bad mother for many, many years. But at some point, as I became an adult, I chose to continue to be a bad son. At some point, I was equally responsible for the pain in our relationship. Whether that was at age 18 or 28, I don't know. But at some point, I was equally culpable for the things that went wrong inside our relationship.
That's something so many of us can relate to. Why do you think you were that way?
I am a world champion grudge holder. I'm mad at things that happened when I was three, not even doing with my mom. So I think part of it is simply my personality and hers. I think we are both world champion grudge holders.
Why did you let your father off so easy compared to your mother?
Because he was easy to love. He was a gentle person, calm, quiet, introverted. And I think one of the big things that inside a warrior culture, like my tribe, like in the Native American world, which is so focused on warriors of the male and female variety and military service and the canonization of war heroes of the past in the military for the United States government and in the Indian battles against the United States government. I think the canonization of that fist, arrow, bullet, that in the midst of all that, my father was so passive and so gentle. I think to have a masculine presence that was so kind was such an antidote, such a revelation, such so refreshing, and it felt so safe for so many people, not just me. In working on this book and talking to friends and family from those years, so many kids, I say kids, they're all my age now, but so many kids remembered our house as being the safe place to be. And in the book, I call it my mother's angry sobriety and my father's drunken kindness. And I think that combo is what made it safe. My mother provided the structure and my father provided the love.
But has that flipped now? I try to think of love as something you do, as how you come through for somebody. You know, how did you work through that from wanting to feel safe, little junior, to now?
That's a fascinating question. That's just killing me right now, Bill, because the thing is, when you talk about acts of love, about the act of doing something that's going to protect the child, my mother did that.
That's why I ask.
My mother had the jobs, and my mother provided the money. My mother was predictable. As I say in the book, my mother was industrious.
Yeah.
And my father, on the other hand, was a random alcoholic. So when you talk about the very act of proving love, my mother did it time and time again, and my father was completely unreliable. And yet, I spent most of my literary career canonizing him and writing about him and believing that he was the primary source of my storytelling. But in working on this memoir, I've realized that that's not true, that my storytelling, my connection to our past, my intensity, my discipline, my soul, my anger, my rage, my everything intense about me that creates the storyteller is primarily from my mother.
And even her not teaching you the ancient language, she says, Junior, English is going to be your best weapon.
She always said that. She said two things to me always. Junior, English is going to be your best weapon. And Junior, you were born with a suitcase in your hand. Is that not handing your child a vision?
Yeah.
Is that not predicting my life? And my mother did that.
Would you mind, we're talking with Sherman Alexie, whose new memoir is called You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. Would you mind reading the eulogy you delivered at your mother's funeral?
Yes, here it is. I said, my mother and I had a difficult relationship. We weren't always kind to each other. So it's good to hear how kind she was to some of you. But it hurts, too, to hear that she mothered some of you better than she mothered me. And it was also good to hear how mean she was to some of you too. I knew the mean Lillian maybe better than all of you, maybe even better than my brothers and sisters. My mother was good to people, and she was mean to people. And sometimes she was good and mean to the same person at the same time. Anyhow, that's all I really have to say. I am not a traditional Indian. You all know that. I don't sing or dance or do the ceremonies. I don't pray like other people pray. I just talk. So I'm really going to miss talking to my mother. I am really going to miss her voice.
You put that in the book, but then you seem really, in the book, very uncomfortable about that.
I didn't tell the truth. I mean, I just glanced off the truth. I looked at the truth with my peripheral vision. I didn't give her the eulogy that was honest and completely accurate, and didn't give her the eulogy she deserved. I mean, this book is that eulogy. I gave the simplest possible version, the gentlest possible version of a eulogy. And it wasn't honest about the heights and depths of knowing Lillian Alexei and being her child. I didn't do that, the extremes. And I spend most of the memoir trying to tell the honest eulogy.
It was eulogy-sized. It was simplified, but why do you say not honest in its leaving out the extremes?
I mean, I didn't talk about the time she threw the can of pop and hit me in the head and knocked me out. I didn't talk about the time she left me on the porch to sleep with the dogs. I didn't talk about the ways in which she quilted for 3 days straight to finish a quilt so that we would get our electricity back in the middle of winter.
With arthritic hands.
Yes, I didn't talk about the hours and hours she would spend working with the elders, working with kids, working with drug and alcohol addicts. I didn't risk the judgment of my fellow tribal members in trying to tell the full story of this human being. I failed as a son, I failed as a eulogist, I failed as a human being in that moment.
Wow, Sherman. Okay, I want to, I haven't asked you about this, if you want to talk about this. Such an important part of this book is the connection you make between rape and legacy. Are you comfortable revealing the part that played in your family?
Yeah, here? I can do that. So,
and it could be a way of setting up, like you wrote this poem called Ancestry, which is a long poem for radio, but I thought maybe you could read a part of it, but it needs a setup from you about what you knew, what you learned.
Well, just to speak in larger terms, when you're talking about Canada and the United States, when you're talking about the most vulnerable group of people, it is Indigenous women who are subject to the most oppression, the most violence, the most sexual violence, and my mother was not spared from any of that. My big sister is the child of a rape. So my mother was raped, and my sister Mary was conceived by that. But also my mother was conceived by rape.
I should say, this was not your father, this is your half-sister Mary.
My half-sister Mary, yeah. So the rapist I'm not related to. And my mother's father, biological father, was a rapist who I'm also, I won't reveal his name. It's not the fault of his children and grandchildren. It was his crime. And my mother, in telling her story and talking about her life, apportioned it to her children. So we all have different parts of her life story, different versions. And I'm the only sibling that she told that she was the biological child of a rape. My sisters didn't know that. My brothers didn't know that. She never said that to them. She only said it to me, and she told that to me in my teen years. And looking back, I think it was her damaged way of asking me to be a better man. I think it was her dysfunctional way of warning me about how Native women are treated and how Native men and non-Native men can treat Native women. I think it was her way of talking about her pain. And she knew I was leaving. I was gone from the reservation already. I was going to a white high school, and she knew I was going to live this larger life. And I think it was her way of telling me to honor women. And I also think in some ways it was her way of wanting to be remembered, her own strength. I mean, I tell you, this book is very difficult, and there's a lot of difficult stories I tell about my mother, but she'd be very proud to be on the cover. And despite the pain, I know she'd be sitting beside me signing the book. My wife, who's Indigenous, told me the other day that her mother, who passed away, her mother and my mother are probably in heaven clicking their false teeth in celebration because there's this book about this amazing Indigenous woman in all of her complications. And the most tragic and terrible complication is the rape. And so I deal with that in various ways inside the memoir. I try to do it in a respectful way, an honorable way, as much as you can about something so terrible. But this poem is about me grappling with what it means to be the brother and the grandchild of rape. So I'll read from the poem.
Yeah, an excerpt.
The poem is called Ancestry. My late mother is the grandmother of this poem. It is her descendant. Disrespectful enough to reveal that my late mother was conceived by rape, that most vicious of amendments. Unlike me, this poem will question my late mother about her conception and self-conception. I'm sorry to interrogate you, mother. I know you're the victim and should be treated with respect. But there are things I'd like to know. When did you first learn you were the child of rape? Who told you? Why did they tell you? Should I even call him your father? Nobody wants to be known as a rapist's daughter. I should tell everybody you were raised by a good man named James, and not by your biological father, yes. Are you angry with me because I've revealed what you chose to conceal? I'm sorry for this intrusion. But I need to know if you saw the rapist's face when you looked into the mirror. Did your mother see him when she looked at you? Is it possible that your mother loved you less than your siblings because of how you were created? Did you ever learn how to be anything other than devastated? Okay. Stop, Sherman, stop. I want to stop this poem and drop the facade.
And then Sherman, this is talking with Sherman Alexie here, the poem goes on to say that rape is our ancestor. I mean, you widen it out beyond your family.
Well, the genocide of Native Americans wasn't just about murdering the body, murdering the culture, murdering the language. It was about murdering hope. It was about murder and rape. It was about violence on all levels. And when we talk about colonization, when we talk about boarding schools, when we talk about invading armies on reservations, when we talk about church and business and government, when we talk about the Dakota Pipeline, even now, what are we talking about but the capitalistic exploitation and violence and murder and rape of the human body, the human soul, the earth, and the ways in which for Indigenous people all that is connected. The land is us. We are the land. So when you're polluting and violating and exploiting land, you're doing that to us as well. You're doing it to everything we hold sacred. So my mother and her mother, in being raped physically, were also raped spiritually. They had salmon taken away from them by the Grand Coulee Dam. They had their entire history shrunk by being placed on a reservation. And despite all that, their love is shown through. despite all that, I'm here, my siblings are here, and we're pretty good people. And I love my siblings. I love my brothers and sisters so much. And I love their wit, and I love their passions. I love their weaknesses and their strengths. And I love how we've been able to love one another, even through all the destruction that's happening now and the destruction of the past. And it's our love that's going to carry us through.
Sherman, at one point, you wrote that you don't know whether you loved your mother or whether she loved you. How do you feel today?
At the moment, of course she loved me. Ask me 10 minutes from now. One of the things I'm realizing is that this book was just the first step of a ceremony. And now that it's going public, it's hitting the shelves tomorrow, the audiobook and ebook as well tomorrow, that now I'm entering the second half of the ceremony. And that's going to involve just as much listening as it involves talking. My friends and family who have read the book are already beginning to tell me about their relationships with their mother. Some great. It's so amazing to hear the stories of amazing mothers, great mothers. And it feels like science fiction, like Good Mother by, you know, Isaac Asimov. And it feels utopian.
Magical realism.
Yes, but also hearing about difficult mothers, difficult parents from people who I wouldn't have thought had come from the same kind of environment as I did, who I'd only thought of in terms of their privilege, but who in fact had just as much pain as I did as a poor res kid.
Sherman Alexie, National Book Award winner, poet, novelist. The new memoir is called You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, and I'm looking at the clock. We have just about 1 minute left. I wonder how you're doing. The listener might wonder, how are you doing?
I'm okay. I've been in therapy for a long time, and I'm properly medicated, folks. So I am feeling the emotions I'm supposed to feel, and I am not judging myself for feeling them.
Thank you for writing it. I just loved reading it, and but I guess that's about all I can say publicly. But I'm glad you're in the world. I love your writing, and thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Writer Sherman Alexie with us on KUOW Seattle. And thank you for tuning in. And we'll be back at you with another show tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.